Everything, I think now everything except for the novels I have footnoted versions of for the rest of the course. So look out for them. I will post, presumably tonight, hello, Emma Espinosa. I will presumably post tonight Tintin Abbey and Daffodils. Footnote, Daffodils is not difficult, but Tintin Abbey you will appreciate the footnotes for. And I've just finished a revised version of the sections of Aurora Lee footnoted for you, which you will be very happy to have, because some of that is quite difficult to understand. So I do strongly advise you to visit the forum and look at those documents. I get the impression that nobody visits the forum practically ever. But anyway, it's meant to be there, to be useful. Right. Hello. Sorry? I believe so. Let's see, just make sure that, because this, I turned this on and it says, how can I tell if I'm actually recording? I was just doing it, wasn't I? I wrote the name and I pressed the button, I believe. How can I tell if I'm actually recording? Damn. You see, if I press this, it's going to stop. I think if it's doing that, it means that it is actually recording. I'm never this. With the other calls, it's just automatic, but I'm pretty sure I could, because I remember writing the name, etc. So let's hope so. Okay, the Rime of the Ancient Mariner is generally considered a romantic work because it is included in lyrical ballads, which is one of the foundational works of English Romanticism. However, if the Rime of the Ancient Mariner were not in that collection of poems by Wordsworth and Coleridge, almost anybody would consider it Gothic poetry. It in fact has much more to do with the Gothic than the Romantic in many ways. It's very much in the tradition of, I don't know how you say it, do you say Leonor or Leonore in German?
Leonor.
Okay, Leonor. There's an E on the end, but by Gottfried Berger, who was one of the Strom, whatever they're called, people. Which was printed for the first time in 1796, so just before this was composed in the monthly magazine. Coleridge, in any case, was a big fan of the German Gothic Schauder novels, which would be, how do you say, Schauderroman? Schauderroman. So that could be the Schauderroman or something. Good. Like it's written. Well, as English, you pronounce it like it's written, but you have problems. But which in English is translated as Schauder novels. Schauder in the sense of temblor, or whatever. It's also quite similar to a number of ballads which Matthew Lewis wrote in the 1790s. Who was Matthew Lewis? The monk, yes, the man who wrote The Monk. And Coleridge had written other things in a similar sort of vein, such as The Mad Monk, which was published in 1800. But Coleridge refused to be published in any volume in which Matthew Lewis was published. Matthew Lewis, despite the fact that he was a member of Parliament, etc., was in literary circles considered beyond the pale, or was unacceptable. So people did not want to be seen in the same group as him in that sort of sense. Wordsworth particularly disavowed and repudiated Gothic literature. He was far too important to be associated with Gothic literature. And that, in fact, is quite ironic, quite amusing, because Wordsworth said much later, I'm not sure if this is actually confirmed by Coleridge, but Wordsworth said much later that the idea of writing a supernatural tale for lyrical ballads in which somebody killed an albatross and there was a zombie ship's crew and somebody wandering trying to get looking for penitence, those were his ideas. So basically he said all of the structure of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner was my idea. But of course he couldn't write it because he couldn't write anything that was in any sense Gothic. So that gives you a little bit of an idea about what Wordsworth was like. There is Stephen E. Jones of Loyola University in Chicago, presumably a Jesuit university, describes The Ancient Mariner as a Gothic horror ballad. And I've given you a link there to his to an article about it in that sense. The Ancient Mariner owes a lot to Coleridge and perhaps to Wordsworth's readings of Renaissance travel literature. No objective is given for this journey, but on entering the Pacific, the poem says, "We were the first that ever burst into the silent sea." So if they were the first or among the first to enter the South Pacific, we can assume that the story is set in the 16th century. Magellan entered the South Pacific in 1520. But there are a number of possible literary and real life sources for this story. There was an account by a man called Philip Quarle, who spent 50 years on an island very much like Robinson Crusoe. And Quarle at one point shot a large, beautiful seabird and with a homemade bow, which he immediately regretted. Another case was the story of Captain George Chevok, whose voyage around the world by way of the Great South Sea, 1726, was read by Wordsworth and Coleridge. Chevok describes how the second mate shot a black albatross while they were rounding Cape Horn, a capital of Dormouse. And of course there is the true story of the Octavius, which was a schooner which was found in 1775 with all those on board frozen. Many of the people were actually frozen in the positions that they were working in. So it was like a sort of quadrivivant of people standing in their posts, like a waxwork museum or something like that, which must have been pretty frightening to come across. So there's actually a lot of the elements in this book, in this poem, are related one way or the other to things which happened in real life. However, we're going to see that some of the mythology and the superstitions related to albatrosses are somewhat mixed. And we know that Joseph Banks, do you know who Joseph Banks was? Joseph Banks is quite important. He was the botanist who accompanied Captain Cook on his voyages and considerably advanced biology, biological sciences, and life sciences with his work. He says in his journal that he shot several albatrosses and even published a recipe for cooking albatross without any negative impact on things. It was also quite common, in fact, for sailors to kill albatrosses and use their feet as tobacco pouches. They presumably, if you take the bones out of their feet, because albatrosses are enormous, they have very, very big feet, and presumably if you cure the leather of their feet or whatever, it's quite good in protecting your tobacco from salt water. Not so good for the albatrosses, but that's another question. So the Ancient Mariner is a tale of a voyage beyond the limits of the known world. There is a very strong sense of geography, of which part of the globe they are moving around, without a direct relationship with to topology. Obviously, to the extent that they are going to places which are unknown, those places don't have names. But there is that helps to make it real in one sense, in the sense that you do get the feeling they're not just sailing now, crossing the equator, and there are changing climates and those gyres and things where they are stranded coincide with real phenomena. By avoiding the names, there's a universality and a dreamlike quality in the story. This is, of course, also a tale of death, nightmare, and hallucination. On a more rational level, we can interpret the story as one of the quite common accounts that happen from time to time, and there are, I know, several from the late 20th century, I don't know any very recently, of traumatic events, travel events, usually at sea, where there is only one survivor. And that survivor, of course, has to try to make sense of what has happened to him or her. Why has he or she survived when nobody else has? And of course, that type of situation can create all sorts of resentments amongst different people. I don't know if any of you have seen that, the Sweet Hereafter, a Canadian film about a group of a school bus which goes off a road, and all the children are killed except for one. And of course, the other parents have a resentment against this family whose child has survived, because they are the only ones whose child has survived. There's a lot of that, a lot of psychology connected to that type of situation of survival. Ow. Good. The reflex is completely useless. That's one thing I do know. Right. So, we have a situation where the mariner's ship sails south, and after crossing the equator, it is carried towards the south polar regions, where the only living thing that it comes across is an albatross. After days in which the bird shares the life of the sailors and becomes a symbol of joy and communion for them, in an action for which he offers no explanation, the mariner shoots the albatross. The ship is then driven north into the Pacific and becalmed, and is stranded, is marooned in a situation where it cannot move. In the equatorial region of the Atlantic, that area is called the doldrums, an area where there are very, very few currents that take you anywhere interesting, and there are very few winds. So if you don't have a engine-operated, a motor-operated ship, it's very easy to be caught in those areas. Apparently, that area in the Atlantic is sometimes called the Sea of Horses. Do you know why? Because the Spanish ships going to South America, if they got caught there, that was typically where they pushed their horses overboard because they could not, couldn't feed them, etc. So there's a lot of dead horses, dead Spanish horses apparently in that part of the Atlantic. Anyway, so in that situation, the sailors suffer from extreme thirst, extreme drought, as it says in the poem. Of course, there is the lion, whatever it is, water or water, and not a drop to drink or whatever it is one of the most famous lines from the whole poem. And of course, there's the huge irony of being in a situation surrounded completely by water, but dying of thirst. The crew members are looking for a scapegoat, and they blame the Ancient Mariner for their situation. And instead of a cross, they hang the albatross around my neck was hung. So you have a situation where a group of people seem to be desperately searching for causality, for events being explicable, if you like. And first, they blame the Ancient Mariner for killing the albatross, and then they celebrate the Ancient Mariner for killing the albatross because winds drive them north out of the polar ocean, out of the Antarctic Ocean, and then they blame him again because they are stuck in whatever the equivalent of the doldrums is in the equatorial region of the Pacific. And this could bring us to the famous phrase, hello, where somebody, I can't quite remember who, but somebody said, novels or fiction is where things happen because, whereas life is where things just happen. And part of the problem of these sailors, of course, is that they are looking for their fate to be motivated by some action, where obviously in real life things often do just happen. And it is not at all clear where Coleridge stands on this. One of the quotes he gives at the beginning of the poem in his marginal notes is about the idea that we live in a world where there are, in modern sense, a number of different dimensions, and so you can have different types of spirits living in our world, and helicopters, different types of spirits living in our world, which take on different forms, and he gives himself permission, as it were, to mix the Virgin Mary and God and the Christian pantheon, if you like, with other types of natural spirits and supernatural spirits, etc. And with an understanding that these are different planes, if you like, different alternative universes, which we give names to, but the names are inadequate because we only see them occasionally. Now, this could be part of the whole fiction of the poem, or it could be literally how Coleridge at this point sees things. Since he is addicted to a number of serious narcotics, he sees more spirits than most of us. It is unclear which of those two things is the case. So they curse the Ancient Mariner, and the Ancient Mariner, apparently as a result of this curse, has to suffer life in death. What happens to the other mariners? What happens to the other mariners?
They die.
So why is it different for him than for them? Why can't he die? Not exactly. What is it that determines that he doesn't die? The albatross determines that he doesn't die, no. No! You haven't read the poem properly. Terrible people. They come across a ghost ship on which death is playing dice with life and death. And life and death wins his soul, which is why he doesn't die. Presumably, all of the other rolls of the dice are won by death. So as you know, God does not play dice with the universe, according to Einstein, but death and life and death do play dice with the universe. So we are given a one of the great symbols of non-causality, of arbitrariness, playing dice, as the reason. I wish it would stop doing that. Stop doing that. Is there somewhere where I can lengthen the time it's open or not? But I won't bother now. Anyway, so we have a situation where everybody is trying to find a motivation for things, but apparently, the punishment for the sailors, who after all have just celebrated at one point that he killed the albatross, they really haven't done a great deal wrong, is more severe than the punishment for the Ancient Mariner. And for those who interpret this poem as a illustration of a some sort of divine order, we need to be able to explain that, and it's quite difficult to do so. Why does he stop? Why does he lose the albatross? Why does he not have an albatross around his neck for the rest of his life? It would be rather unpleasant. Sorry? Yeah, but the sailors then get the dead albatross and hang it around his neck. Under what are the circumstances by which the albatross falls off his neck and he no longer has to carry the albatross around? No? Oh, you terrible, terrible people. You have not prepared your class. People in Sibirlandia, do you know why? It's your big chance to participate while I drink a cup of tea. Now what they do is they connect, they say hi, and then they go and do something else. They're not really there. After the other sailors have died, looking at him, eyes are very important, glints in eyes and things are very, very important. He sees lots of sea monsters, nasty sea snake type things, and is ill, how disgusting. But after a couple of days, He unconsciously blesses the sea monsters as other living things. Yeah? These nasty, slimy snakes and things are living. And he sees that there is a communion between himself and these sea monsters, so he blesses them. Yeah? And at that point, the albatross drops from around his neck and it starts to rain. And so he, if you like, part of the penitence that's been imposed on him is reprieved, because, if you like, he has learnt a lesson. He's learnt about the oneness of nature. Very, very important for an antique concept. Yeah? All living things are valuable, are important from that point of view. Apparently, or maybe this is a coincidence, because we've already seen that the whole situation with the albatross is much better explained as something which is a coincidence than as something which is the cause of the rest of what happens to this man and other people. So after making the blessing, the albatross falls from around his neck. He is able to pray again. The situation of drought, of thirst, gives way to rain, and the mariner is brought mysteriously home. Angels, or some type of benevolent spirits, occupy the dead bodies of the mariners. It's not the mariner's spirit coming back, it's different spirits, and help to take the boat back to Scotland. So we could understand this poem as being a little bit like King Lear, in the sense that we have various people, obviously more people in the case of King Lear, trying to find reason and a moral cause in a universe which potentially does not have one. There's much more direct contradiction in King Lear. Every time somebody says, God bless him, or something like this, in King Lear, something awful happens. It's much better. If you ever find yourself in King Lear, just keep your mouth shut. It's much, much better than trying to call down the blessings of the gods. But there's a similar sort of position there, where we don't quite know what the author is trying to suggest, and there's a strong implication that this is a nihilistic world. So, what is wrong with all of those pictures? What is wrong with the illustrations by, wonderful illustrations by Gustave Doré, which you have looked at, according to Coleridge? And wrong, I'm not sure if Coleridge was actually talking about those illustrations, but all of the illustrations that he had seen of his poem.
Yeah? Mariner
seems to be old. The opposite. The mariner seems to be relatively old there, whereas for Coleridge, all of this happened when the mariner was young. You have a situation where Coleridge says that he has told his story 10,000 times since the voyage. If he's told it 10,000 times, even if he does so quite regularly, that's quite a long time ago, one would assume. So there's also this process of how stories get embellished and how people try to find meaning to their experience as they grow older. We'll tend to also to change stories so that things fit to some sort of process of cause and effect. One of the things we know that was exercising, that was obsessing Coleridge at this time, was the idea of the origins of evil. And for him, possibly the origins of evil reside in the mind's needy attempts to make sense of experience that is really arbitrary, as the rolling of the dice that appears in the mariner's story. So we need to decide to what extent there is any sort of causality. In justifying his use of the supernatural in the poem, Coleridge explained that its function was to express elements from our inward nature. So again, part of what is being explored here is psychology, and also and especially psychology under stress, which again, that is one of the main interests of Gothic literature, much more than Romantic literature. The use of the supernatural was, for Coleridge, a technique of psychological revelation. It allowed the poet to bring into play in his poems the hidden forces of the mind. In The Ancient Mariner, the chief of these hidden forces is guilt, especially as it exists in the mind to some extent independent of cause. We all tend to feel guilty, and in this case we have the guilt of the sole survivor, and so what has possibly been described here is somebody who feels guilty because he is the sole survivor, reaching back to find what is the cause, why he is to blame for the death of all of his crew mates. The mariner's experiences include transgression and apparent retribution, but there is discontinuity between them. The Ancient Mariner is one of several distinguished literary works on the phantasmagoria of crime and punishment. So, of course, we have crime, we have punishment meted out by the state, as it were, but there is also the punishment of the mind that feels guilty. And, of course, a lot of things like crime and punishment are about much more about that. I have my glasses, so that should make my life easier, I hope. But there are too many pockets in this thing. So, one second. It must be somewhere. I think I have my glasses. Maybe I don't have my glasses. Yes, I have decades of experience of criticizing my wife's bags, and now I have a bag which is the same. So, but the difference is my wife has a number of different bags. Yes, go ahead. Got one of those, yes. And what she wants is always in one of the other ones. Right. Tea? Nevada? And apparently, I have forgotten my glasses, so there are no glasses. You have to check what I say against my notes. I may just be making it all up because I can't see anything. I thought I remembered putting them in. That's apparently not. Okay, no glasses. Doesn't matter. I can more or less see. In the poem, events which we suppose to need motive take place without motive. The mariner does not know why he shoots the albatross. And potentially, this could be the main sin. There's no suggestion here that this is a boatload of vegetarians, so presumably these mariners are catching fish or eating things. Maybe the great crime here is the fact that the ancient mariner has killed the bird without any motivation. If he was killing it to eat it, that would be a different thing. An interesting thing, which is completely irrelevant, which I heard yesterday. Did you know that for 1,000 years, Japan was a vegetarian country, presumably eating fish also, but otherwise vegetarian country. But late in the 19th century, somebody spotted the emperor eating beef. And from that point on, they changed over to eating, to being non-vegetarian. The emperor was secretly eating beef, and they found out. So? Well, presumably, or he had had it imported or something. But I imagine there were very few cows. They weren't being for milk or whatever, presumably. But anyway, that is something I heard yesterday. May not be true, but anyway. And again, he blesses the living creatures unaware. Again, that you would expect if part of his sentence is commuted, as it were, by the fact that he blesses these animals, you would expect it to be a conscious act, but it isn't. It's a subconscious act. So that's, again, calls into question our idea of motivation, etc. His regenerative acts bring about only partial restoration. He remains a frightening figure. The impact of whose experiences unsettles ordinary life. The wedding guest to whom he tells his tale turns shunned from the feast, sadder but wiser. Again, there's the possibility, is that sadder but wiser, that third last line of the poem, which you haven't read, is that an expression of going from innocence to experience? Is this a parallel of Blake's writing in that sense? It would be a perfectly, perfectly good question in the exam if you were asked to illustrate the concepts of innocence and experience in the writings of different first generation romantic writers, and in that we can very clearly, the case of Blake is obvious. You would want to quote this phrase in terms of the ancient mariner, and in the case of Tintern Abbey, that is very much what Wordsworth is going on about, as we will see next week. So be aware of that concept of innocence or experience, because if you come across the exam and you're suddenly thinking, Blake and? Sadder but wiser is not a difficult expression to remember, and is very useful in terms of answering that sort of question. The pilot's boy, the pilot is the person who takes the ship into the harbour, the pilot's boy goes mad. What's he done? Why is he to blame for anything? The process of punishment seems to be only partially related to sin. And again, I think there is an element in relation to something like King Lear. In King Lear, all of the bad people are punished, but most of the good people are punished as well. It's not exactly clear how this moral universe works in that sense. The Ancient Mariner is a man reduced to his simple, bare essence, almost unaccommodated man in that sense, and that essence is simply the obsessive memory of what brought him to this extreme. This process of being at sea, being become at sea, being almost dying of thirst, watching 200 other men die of thirst who blame him in one sense or another, is the defining moment in his life. And that is his obsession, because he doesn't have a good psychologist, psychiatrist, for the rest of his life. And to some extent, that's all that's being described here from a more logical, less gothic point of view. Coleridge also asks the reader to pay careful attention to the near constant interaction between spiritual and between the spiritual and temporal worlds in his home. Basically, you have, for Coleridge, you have a sphere which is reality as we know it, material reality. You have spiritual worlds, probably in plural, and one of the main areas that connects those two things is the natural world. And to some extent, the albatross can be seen as a conduit between those two things. What is the nature of albatrosses? What do you know about albatrosses? Yeah, they spend months just flying. They have a special ability for their wings to lock into place. So there's not an effort of holding the wings out, they just lock into place. And they can literally fly for months. So they are very much part of the ethereal, aerial world, as it were, rather than the material world. One of the possible interpretations of what the mariner is doing is converting something which is ethereal, something which is related to the air, into something which is material, dead body. And that is possibly his crime in relation to the spirit world. The natural world, which is closely connected to the spirit world, makes the sailors lose control of their course. In part four, we find out that the moon rules the oceans. Hello, good up. It has been suggested that the moon represents the Virgin Mary. And while the force 9 fathoms under the sea represents the Greek goddess or Poseidon, sorry, God or Poseidon or Pluto. Someone is one of these, which I think were brothers, weren't they? Anyway. No? Well, whichever we prefer. So we have there is this concept of multiple spirit worlds which have been, if you like, revealed at different times to people. You have the whole sort of Christian veneer on one level, you have ghosts, etc. You have the classical gods. Hello. They are allowed to interact. Where have we seen that before? Who else has mixed classical gods, ancient gods, and the Christian God, etc., etc.? What is the most influential book for the whole of this course? Milton, yes. Paradise Lost. Paradise Lost includes Beelzebub and Baal and all of these Philistine gods and different gods from around the Mediterranean world as what do you call it, as minor devils who support Satan. And so there is some precedent for Coleridge being allowed to do this, because Milton did it, so it must be all right. What is a bit strange, if you like, is the mixture, including in that mix, ghosts and things, which, if you like, is a new element to the mixture. So the Christian figures have control over the pagan ones, but they coexist. The sun is equated with God in Coleridge's poetry. So he attributes the first phase of the mariner's suffering to God when they are dehydrated by the sun in the Bacchan Sea. So it's much more of a sort of Old Testament vengeful desert god than a modern understanding of, or New Testament understanding of God. Whereas what happens at night tends to be where there is clemency shown to the mariner or to the sailors, and that is under the influence of the Virgin Mary. Which is interesting, because as far as I remember, Coleridge's father was an Anglican. Was Unitarian, well, even more so then. It's interesting that he has, because Coleridge at this stage is sort of moving away from Protestantism, but into a more sort of general understanding of some sort of polytheism. But the use of the Virgin Mary is quite interesting from somebody coming from that background. So, as I say, the nasty things, if you like, happen to the crew during the day when the world is ruled by the sun, stroke of God, and the kinder things tend to happen at night, which is what is ruled by the moon, stroke the Virgin Mary. And of course there is very, very much that idea in a lot of literature. We saw it in Frankenstein, where the moon is seen as feminine and changeable and blah, 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 and the sun is seen as masculine. One of the ways that lots of people try to understand this poem is in terms of its liminal spaces. What do I mean by liminal spaces? Boundaries, thresholds, umbrales, that's what I'm going to say. Is it important that the encounter between the ancient mariner and the wedding guest takes place at a threshold? It's a threshold in a double sense. It's a threshold in the sense that a couple are getting married, so it's a threshold in that particular moment, which is sort of the before and after of these two individuals' lives. And it's also a threshold in the sense that he is at the door of the church about to go in. So it's a threshold in a very physical sense as well. What other liminal spaces are there in this poem which you have not read? No? Well, one of the liminal spaces, sorry? Sunset, yes. Sunset, sundown, dusk, twilight is a liminal time and is important. A lot of the important things happen at twilight in this thing, but it's not a space, it's a time. One of the liminal spaces is the polar regions. H2O appears there in three different forms. We have ice, we have water, and we have mist. Where the supposedly the fundamental act of the whole story takes place, the killing of the albatross. He's in a doubly liminal space in that sense. We have water in its three forms there. How can you say frozen mist in English? How can you say frozen mist?
Snow is not frozen mist.
When mist freezes, I think it's below about minus 30 degrees in form. It's called diamond dust. And that's about, Oh dear.
It just
thank you. Okay. It was very painful for me to do it. That's all right, I'm joking. R-I-M-E. See if I'm allowed to write it here. Run, yes. Now, the usual way of understanding the name of this poem, which you have not read, but hopefully you have read at least the title of the poem, is to understand that it is just an archaic spelling of run. But another way of understanding it is understanding this, the title of the poem, as the frozen mist of the ancient mariner. So, there's your dictionaries. You can find it in your dictionaries, that R-I-M-E, word of the meanings is frozen mist. So you have a situation where the principal event of the story happens in this liminal context of frozen mist, and that is referred to potentially in the title of the story. Didn't know that, did you? Right. And this is one of the most threatening worlds that we are presented with in the whole of the poem. It's not necessarily the loudness or the coldness or the desolateness of the icy world that makes it so terrifying. What makes it so terrifying for the mariners is that nothing is easily definable. We have, everything is in, if you like, some sort of state of flux between ice, water, mist. You can't see things properly, etc., etc. And if you like, we have this older man's interpretation of what happened to him when he was a young man through this mist, through this rhyme. Okay. So hopefully we are ready for some possible interpretations. Coleridge seems to suggest that there are three spheres: the social, the natural, and the supernatural. The social is represented by the wedding party. It separates us from the supernatural. The supernatural works through the natural and can be and we can experience the sublime or the supernatural through our interaction with the natural. So, first question, which I would ask you if you had read the poem, is it important that the storytelling takes place at a wedding? And you would think about that and give me answers. Has anybody read the poem yet? Or nobody? Nobody at all who read the poem? Yes? Tell me, is it important that it takes, do you think? Have you come across weddings in English literature before? Yes. What is the wedding the supreme symbol of in literature? Happiness. It can be connected to nature. Regeneration and community. Okay, so the wedding is connected with the with orderly reproduction, if you like, the orderly transfer to another generation, the continuity of the community. So this, if you like, is the supreme moment of community, the celebration of community, of love and hope for that community. It is precisely a divorce from such an easy, loving social world that the mariner will force the wedding guest to participate in. The wedding guest is taken out of that situation, is not allowed to participate, because of the eyes, remember, eyes are important, and is forced to hear the story. We can approach the sublime by recognizing beauty in nature. We can also approach the supernatural through prayer. Who is the supreme figure of prayer? Who prays more than most people for the romantics? What type of religious figure got the romantics excited? Sorry? Okay, but on the other side. Who appears in the poem that you have not read except for you? Sorry? Who is the last major character to appear in the poem? Once the mariner has got home, who does he interact with? You got a picture? No? A hermit.
Oh,
yes, yes. Why a hermit? Why were hermits especially sexy, especially important for the romantics? Yes. There are people who are dedicating their lives to prayer, but they're also dedicating their lives to nature. They're going outside the social and living in the natural. And we will find hermits coming up again in Tintern Abbey next week. Tonight, I will post a footnoted version of Tintern Abbey for you. The fact that it is footnoted means that you can read it in less than a quarter of an hour. You don't have to be looking words up, etc., etc. Please come to class with the poetry read, because it will make it infinitely more useful, and there will also be the possibility for you to speak and not just listen to me, so we can interact even. We have that that element of his final, the first person that he tells his tale to is the hermit, and hermits are important for the romantics because of that type of relationship. Is it important that hypnotism is implied? We have a situation where the ancient mariner controls the wedding guest with his eyes. Yeah? So the wedding guest is unable to go into the wedding, despite the fact that he clearly wants to, because of the glint in Shemaiah's eyes. You have to decide. When you read the poem, you will decide. Is it important that it's one of the three? Is it important that the wedding guest is one of three? Is it just the fact that it's not everybody, or is that possibly a reference to the Trinity? You have to decide if that's important. Does the albatross represent Christ, or is it just Christ-like? In what sense might you understand the albatross as a Christian symbol? It's a bird. It's a bird. Yeah, bad. Bird. Sorry? Okay, it's a white bird as well. Yeah? It's specifically, it's a white bird. So we could associate it with the Holy Spirit and, if you like, therefore, one step on, with Christ. There is that element of sacrifice. Does it fully work as a symbol of Christ or not? Mm. Yes? Okay.
It's because it's supposed to hear the stomach, this little bird in the
food. Well, isn't that pelicans?
Yeah. Albatross
is all? Oh. But is that true or?
I think it's not.
Very nice. Okay. Is it important that the mariner's act is not a crime under human law? There's not a situation, nobody is in a situation where the other seaman can arrest the mariner for doing something which is illegal. It's not something which he can be punished by human laws for. So is there an element to which what has happened is he has broken some natural law rather than some human law, and so cannot find some human punishment in that sense? Think about it. Is it relevant that the only women in the whole story are the bride and life in death? Death is not? Okay, but depends, Pride and Prejudice, or Plenty of Women, in a mariner context, sure, yeah. But the only people that he comes across in Scotland are men as well. I mean, he doesn't come across an anchorite, he comes across a hermit, a male hermit, etc. The personification of death here, as tends to be the case in Anglo culture, is male, not female. Pretty sure. From when I was putting the notes on the poem, which you have not read, I'm pretty sure it said he. Almost certain. But life and death is she, and in some sense, in terms of the description, is some type of diabolical temptress almost. She's described as a sort of beautiful corpse in some sense. I think she is long and that sort of thing. So you don't think that's relevant at all? Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Is there an allegory of the fall, purgation, salvation of the individual or humanity? Only possibly in the sense that the purgation is partial, the salvation is partial, and these things are incomplete and don't seem to be very precisely directed. Is it a myth expressing the romantic belief in the one life? What is that? What is the one life? No, the idea of there is a communion between all living things, okay, which is quite important for the romantics. Is the poem the basic Christian drama of sin, repentance, salvation, adapted to the romantic sense of the one life and the holiness of all that lives? Perhaps. And they're not yes or no questions, they're things to think about. It's unclear whether there is a complete coherence here, whether that is intentional, or whether that is the fact that Coleridge had taken rather too much laudanum and rather too much opium is another question. I would suggest that probably what we have here is a questioning of our need to impose causality and logic to stories on the one hand, and also this romantic idea that we've already seen with Blake of stories being there to provoke our imagination rather than tell us what is right or wrong. It's more important that you think imaginatively than that you're being told what to think. And that understanding of things seems to fit probably better than most of the other possible interpretations. Is it a symbolic expression of how imagination reveals spiritual realities that cannot be grasped by understanding alone? Is it a dramatization of Coleridge's deep sense of sin and a nightmare of being damned for some wholly involuntary act? Is the fact that the mariner doesn't even know why he shot the bird, is that a mitigating factor or an extenuating factor or what's the opposite? Aggravating factor. Or is it irrelevant? The fact that he did it. You have to decide. Is it a nightmare voyage into the irrational, akin to a nightmare of inexplicable and inescapable guilt and suffering? We know that Kublai Khan was inspired in a drug-induced dream by Coleridge. If we are to believe Wordsworth gave the main ideas for this, but it's still possible that the rest of the story was filled out a little bit by Coleridge on some of his favourite drugs. So there may be an incoherence and a nightmarishness there because of that. Is it a parable in which one man's exceptional crime and exceptional experience are rewarded by greater consciousness and vision into the meaning of existence? What is the moral of the story? Why is the wedding guest sadder but wiser? Well, we can understand why he's sadder, if you like. He's missed his wedding, and he's one of the main guests. But why is he wiser? What has this story actually told us? No, don't shoot others. Good. Not a particularly practical lesson for people living in England in the at the end of the well, there's not many albatrosses in England. I think they're only in the Pacific, aren't they? Well, they're in the North Atlantic. And the albatrosses, I don't think so. Well, anyway, I'm not sure. There are lots of seabirds, but I don't think albatrosses. No. Albatrosses are quite exotic from an English point of view, so I wouldn't have thought so. Give us the name Alcatraz, isn't it? But that's in the Pacific. Is it a parable about the role of the poet and the human cost of being gifted?
Only the Southern Hemisphere.
Only the South, the Southern Hemisphere,
Southern Hemisphere. Atlantic and Pacific, the South.
Okay. This is something I cannot get used to. The fact that there are no mysteries ever left in life. Anything you are, you mention in the conversation, people can hear.
There are. You just wanted to know. With your question.
Okay, but. About what is the poem about? Yeah, okay. But I mean, in terms of that sort of thing, all facts, all things that can be considered facts are instantly available. It's very, very bad if you have a tendency to be a bullshitter. You tend to make things up. People suddenly have these facts.
No, that's not good.
It's interesting because in terms of documentaries, I seem to remember people describing them sort of doing large parts of the Pacific, so actually going into the Northern Pacific. But anyway, whatever. Is that a new? Yeah. But I mean, but they don't actually depend on ships, presumably.
No, but the animals, they tend to.
Yeah, opportunists.
Just come one.
Yeah. Maybe. Anyway, getting past our albatrosses. Is it a parable about the role of the poet and the human cost of being gifted with strange powers of speech? So from that point of view, this is a tale of meta-literature. The Ancient Mariner has a story to tell, which is a good thing, it's something special that he has, but it's also something that he has to tell. He is outside society, and he can only find momentary satisfaction by telling his tale. And he has to repeatedly tell his tale. Is there an element to which, there's the idea that this tale inside the poem has to be told to certain people, and he knows which those people are. But we are being told the tale outside the poem. Are we specifically chosen? Is there some sort of metaphysical idea that this poem has chosen us, and that's why we are reading it, or is it because it is on the syllabus of Estudios Ingleses, Grado Dos? That element also you have to decide the relevance of that. Is the poem about the dread of loneliness, which was something of an obsession for Coleridge? Is it a rewriting of the central romantic myth, The Wandering Jew? I'm not quite sure about the pronunciation. This figure was somebody who supposedly mocked, who ridiculed Christ during the process of walking to Calvary, and was punished by having to wander the earth until the day of judgment. And this figure is somebody who comes up quite a lot in romantic and gothic literature. We have one of those, The Wanderer, I think it was one of the later gothic novels, if you remember. In fact, supposedly the last sighting of this individual, surprisingly, was in 1774 in Brussels, where else? It is still something which is part of this generation as a myth of something, that this figure does appear in Europe to almost contemporary times with the poem. Is the poem about the human need to apply meaning to events which are in fact determined by arbitrary fortune? So, once you have read the poem, please read through those questions and try and think about your answers to those questions, because that will hopefully lead you to some sort of understanding. Birds can be understood as liminal creatures, and as we saw, albatrosses even more so. The albatross is quite interesting in that it has both traditions of good luck and bad luck to, at least to British mariners. It's a little bit like black cats in Britain, which are considered by some people lucky and by other people unlucky. For some sailors, albatrosses were believed to bring bad luck or at least storms. For others, killing albatrosses was the unlucky thing. And the albatross, as a white bird, as I said, could be associated with the Holy Spirit. Of course, if the killing of the albatross did cause the adverse weather conditions, then the other sailors make themselves complicit by praising the killing when they thought it cleared away the fog, cleared away the rime. If it was the albatross itself that brought the bad luck rather than its killing, then the ancient mariner is simply a scapegoat who internalizes his persecution. Life and death can be considered the exact opposite of the albatross. She symbolizes life drained of all meaning and joy, whereas the albatross symbolized joy and communion for the mariners. Further question, what is the relationship between the spirits beneath the sea and life in death? Are they in league or are they just coincidental? Do we have these different spiritual levels just touching our material plane, or are they interacting with each other as well? None of that is particularly clear, but you have to come to some sort of decision if you want to interpret the poem. Another thing which will come up again when we are discussing the romantics is stasis. Qu'est-ce que c'est stasis? Okay, situation of where time is stopped, where things no longer progress, things no longer develop. The difference between what is happening in a picture and what is that picture is representing. The picture stops time, if you like. And stasis is an important concept for the romantic. Again, you might have an essay question about important concepts for the romantics. And so far we have stasis, hermits of fun, the oneness of nature, sublimity. So you should be aware of those and try and make some sort of list for yourselves, because that could easily come up. The other sailors die when the ship is stranded, is immobile. The mariner is caught in stasis in that he cannot proceed with his life. So, a voyage, of course, is one of the great symbols of life. The beauty, mon flux tranquille, and all those types of ideas about flowing, movement, etc. The stopping of that process when there is no current, and when they're in the middle of the Pacific, is part of that is a situation of stasis, and life in death is stasis. One of the big ideas for the Romantics is that death, if you like, is a proof of life. If we did not decline and die, we wouldn't be alive. It is the fact of declining and dying and becoming old that proves that we are alive. And we will see, for example, Keats comparing that process with what you have in art. Art can be perfect, but because it is trapped in a situation of stasis, it is not alive, it is dead. And the Ancient Mariner is trapped in that moment for his life and death. He is continually reliving that moment and so cannot get on with his life. But all characters in a story are in stasis. Heidi, Orlando, King Lear are trapped inside their stories. They cannot move outside their stories, and so they also suffer from stasis. Once a character is set in a story, he or she experiences a living death, surviving perpetually in the story, but are unable to move beyond it. The Mariner no longer exists outside the story and is condemned to repeat it indefinitely. The Mariner becomes the story. So one of the things that Coleridge could be saying is that all characters in literature are the Ancient Mariner, are in that situation. Okay, I'll talk a little bit about narrative technique in the notes, but you can read that, it's not that interesting. What, if anything, does the wedding guest learn? Ultimately, what do we learn? One effect of the Mariner's tale is to cause the wedding guest to imagine that which we know. That is a quote from Shelley. There are things that we know intuitively that literature can make overt, can make explicit. So we come to an inward awareness of something which we already know in theory. It's a type of illustration of intuitive knowledge. That there really is a moral universe that cannot be violated with impunity. Is that the case, or is it exactly the opposite? A guy called W.J. Bates came to that conclusion. I'm not sure it's almost exactly the opposite in this case, but anyway. We may all feel that to be so, but Coleridge says, truths are too often considered as so true that they lose all the powers of truth and lie bedridden in the dormitory of the soul. To quote from him there. Is it this truth that the Mariner himself must constantly revive, perhaps until the message that he can extract from it corresponds in a more adequate manner to the power of the tale itself? Perhaps. There is also the question of the marginal glosses. In the later version of the poem, not the version that was published in Lyrical Ballads, but Coleridge added lots of notes to the poem. There are functional reasons for this. One of the positive things is it slows down the reading of the poem. It makes you stop and think about it. Because the poem is written in a ballad style, and is quite exciting, there's a lot of action, we tend to read through it quickly. And that means that you don't ponder about what it's saying. So the marginal notes can be useful there. But the marginal notes are also a way in which Coleridge makes fun of us and makes fun of himself by introducing spurious ideas and sometimes even sort of comical expressions, like he talks about Platonic Constantinopolians and things like this, using pompous terms to describe different philosophical approaches to the story. And that idea of looking for meaning and imposing meaning on something which may or may not have any. It is very, very difficult to see any sort of basic Christian reading of the poem, in the sense that justice is so arbitrary. Because of the killing of one seabird, one man is condemned to eternal torment. 200 men are condemned to death, and to an agonizing death as well, and a boy goes mad. Because the fates of the mariner and his shipmates are settled by a game of dice. That is not any type. That sort of arbitrariness is not the type of moral universe that we are normally presented with, but is perhaps the type of moral universe that you can find in nihilistic literature like King Lear. We are but flies to the gods, they will kill us for their sport and that sort of thing. That idea of being of no practical concern to whatever spiritual forces control the world. Is the world therefore guided simply by luck and chaos? Blah, 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 blah. Blah, 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 blah. The Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, along with texts like The Four Zoas by Blake or Frankenstein, can be seen, at least in hindsight, as part of a romantic project to replace medieval Christian mythology with a set of stories that are open to allegorical interpretation and are more in accordance with the radical views of the Romantics. And to the extent that a lot of these stories have gone on to define a lot of modern culture, there are constant references in almost anything at sea. But for example, Pirates of the Caribbean is constantly making references to the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. But the if we see as part of the Gothic Romantic project, Frankenstein, the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, Dracula, all of these types of things, there is a modern secular mythology set up by these people and potentialized, if you like, by cinema above all, which does to some extent serve the purposes of a mythology for 20th, 21st century society. Whether that was the project or not is another question. And of course these people are constantly referring back to other mythologies. We've talked a lot about Prometheus and the importance of Prometheus for the Romantics. Has Coleridge intentionally played with his reader, setting out possible meanings that are never fully established? Is Coleridge, Blake-like, trying to provoke the reader into thinking imaginatively rather than telling him or her the right or the wrong answer? They mentioned Coleridge believed that it was important for the individual to acknowledge his or her alienation from nature in order to finally transcend this alienation through the use of the imagination to unite the mind with nature. This process requires the reader to participate in the production of the text's meaning. So you have to be thinking about the text in order to rediscover nature. But the use of nature, the spiritual use of nature, is taken a step further, as we will see in Tintin Abbey and I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, which we will look at next week. We look at Wordsworth. And I will try not to be too nasty about it. Any questions? Please, please, please come to class with the original text prepared. I can be nasty about this and say, if I've made the effort to footnote the text, you can make the effort to read it. But it will mean that you can get much more out of the class, and it doesn't mean just listening to me talking. It means that you can participate more, which is probably worse for them, but better for you. So please do that. I will post that tonight for you. Bye-bye.